I think for a lot of people, a lot of younger people, there's nowhere else to turn. To be honest, they're looking for the answer of how the hell am I going to survive this world and this economy, and you literally have to make your own world and your own economy.
Welcome to the Off-Grid Outpost podcast, where we discuss the journey to real liberty through self-sufficiency, counter-economics, non-aggression, and the agora.
The Outpost represents the border between societal norm and the pioneer spirit. Every episode contains practical, philosophical, and technical information you can use to gain the freedom you deserve. Hey everyone, it's Regina with the Off-Grid Outpost podcast. I am here with my buddy Cyrus.
Morning.
And today we are talking about agorism. What is agorism? What is counter-economics and how to apply it in your everyday life?
Yay!
Yay. I'm really excited about this topic. I realize that I am, like, a practicing agorism without even realizing it.
Yeah, everyone has done agorism at one point in their life, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, I was an agorist for nearly 12 years before I knew what agorism was.
Interesting. Yeah, I've definitely applied it just for the sheer sake of survival, you know, surviving in this economy, and I was a single mom, and,
yeah,
you know, so I had to make extra money, you know, that no one knew about. Like, it was just a sheer form of survival, and, you know, so what is it like? Okay, so an agorist, the agora, agorism, there's, like, different ways to put it.
Yeah, so the simplest way to describe the difference between agorism and counter-economics is that agorism is more about the philosophy and the theory, and counter-economics is the actual tactic, the day-to-day use.
So I guess we should, like, take a step back and just address, what is agorism? What is the definition, the sheer definition of it?
Well, there's actually more than one definition.
Of course.
There's a theoretical meaning, which is you're attempting to starve the state of income and influence by intentionally participating in gray and black markets.
I love that.
So most people will participate in gray markets.
Yes.
You know, they'll pay a kid $20 to mow their lawn. They'll pay a lady, you know, whatever, to cut their hair or whatever, but there's no intention behind it. They're not thinking, ooh, I'm starving the state of this money and influence.
Interesting.
So agorism is the intention behind doing a lot of the things that normal people do all the time.
Yeah. Okay.
And then there's a more practical meaning, which is trying to increase your voluntary interaction while decreasing your coerced interaction.
Okay.
So having an intentional thought of how can I live in a way that is more voluntary and reduce all the coercion that is in my life. And all the coercion in your life is the state.
Yeah, let's go into this voluntary versus coercion concept. So if you go back to our What is the State episode, where we go over government and its true values, you can get a better idea of this voluntary versus coercion theory. But in agorism, what does that mean?
As an agorist, I believe that all interactions should be voluntary. That is one of the main tenets of agorism. Like, I should not be forced into an interaction.
Yes.
Everything should be a choice. And when it comes to government, none of it is a choice, because every action by the government, everything that is mandatory or everything that is prohibited, it's all backed by the barrel of the gun, as we've talked about before. So none of it is by choice, even if you are made to believe it is by choice.
And they do. They brainwash the crap out of us into believing it is our choice. but it's a very convoluted way of coercion. Yeah.
Right, which when we talked about the idea of consent and how they get around all of that. So if, when you talk about voluntary actions, one of the main reasons you get there, if you're using logic, mm-hmm. is if I believe that I own myself, that means I also have to believe that everyone else owns themselves or their yes. selves. I don't know how you would say that correctly. But, and if I own myself, then you can in no way force me to do something unless you have this idea that in some way you own me.
Mm.
Like it, so goes back to the slave master relationship.
Yeah.
The master has the right to force the slave to do something because the master owns the slave.
Mm-hmm.
But if I believe I own myself and you don't own me, then you can't force me to do anything except, you know, through the threat of violence. And if I am sufficiently afraid of the violence, I will do what you want.
So voluntary versus coercism. I don't think that's a word. Coercism. Coercion. I have a knack for making coercion. Up very great words.
Yeah. Awesome.
Like coercism is the theory uh-huh. or the philosophy of coercion.
Right. Okay. I'm sure awesome. I'm down.
I think I just made that up. So, yeah. So coercion is government basically forcing you to pay taxes, income tax, social security tax, unemployment tax, sales tax, real estate tax. Holy crap. How many taxes do you think the government has over us that we can't opt out of? I mean, like, how many really is it? It's got to be at least 7 or 8.
It's more than that. It's way more than that. We don't even know them all.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even know them all. A permit is a tax. Oh, so,
yeah, that's a good point.
You know, if I want to become an electrician and I want to be a licensed electrician, a license is a tax.
License, I mean, is there's, a tax, yeah.
We don't even know all of the tax. Anytime you are handing money to the government, it is a tax.
Mm. You know, and they always use it in the facade of, you know, to protect us or to help us. And it's really, that's all just a big smoke and mirrors game.
Absolutely it is. I mean, take a driver's license, for example. When you ask them, why do I have to have a license? And they tell you it's for your own safety. Well, we all know that's bullshit because maybe I said that a little harshly.
That was funny.
I mean, I know a lot of, I don't have a driver's license. And I believe I'm one of the best drivers on the road. I mean, I'm very cautious. I'm very defensive. And I know a lot of people who are awful drivers that have driver's licenses.
Well, that's a good point.
Having a driver's license has nothing to do with safety.
Zero. And so if you ask someone, why do we have a driver's license? And then this person responds, I would think like the top three answers would be like, it's for our safety. It's to provide identification and it helps, you know, the fees help build roads or something like that. That's more registration, but it kind of falls into the same. Like, I think all three mm-hmm. of those can be completely debunked within 30 seconds.
Yeah, well, I think one of them is probably accurate. It is to identify you.
Yes, yes. But do we need to, like, identify ourselves? Like, why do we have to identify ourselves in a system with numbers? You know? It kind of yeah. goes back to that
foundation. Because the government... Yeah, you have to identify yourself in that way because the government believes it owns you.
Yes. It's a form of ownership.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then, going back to like the safety, you know, having a driver's license for safety. So when I got my driver's license, you know, I was like 16 and I like drove around the block in a small town and parallel parked.
Right.
So I'm feeling like they're,
yeah.
you know, their system for defining a safe driver because they can drive around the block and parallel park when you're 16. I mean, I haven't taken a driving test, you know, in 22 years.
Right.
I think I had a half-ass eye exam where I actually, like, have a little bit of eyesight problems, but I got through the test by, like, closing my bad eye so I could, like, see.
Right. So I got around the system that. And got your license. Well, I remember my driver's test, when it came to the parallel parking, which growing up where I grew up, I don't even know why that was part of the test. Like, I've never had to parallel park in my life.
You know what? You're right. What the hell? Like, okay, there is parallel parking in California. I will say that. But.
Yeah, I can imagine there are places where you need to know.
Yeah, there are some places, but not many.
During my test, the guy says, we kind of drove around for a while and we were in this residential area and there was a car parked on the street. And he said, parallel park behind that car. And so I pulled up behind it and parked. Yeah. And he goes, don't you know what parallel parking means? And I'm like, yeah, I know what parallel parking means. He goes, well, parallel park here. I was like, there's one car.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, like, that's not the point.
Like, there wasn't two cars to park between. Yeah. So
that's hilarious.
Anyway. Yeah. Driver's licenses don't have anything to do with safety.
No.
Absolutely not.
0%. Yeah, you know, what the hell? Like, what is the point of a freaking driver's license other to show your identification to a cop pulling you over to make sure that you're not having a bench warrant for not paying, like, freaking, like, parking tickets?
Yeah, it's to identify you. That's the only reason.
Yeah, and to get money from you.
Maybe, yeah, and to get money from you. Although I imagine, you know, I think it was like $35 when I got mine. So it's not a lot of money. So I imagine that's not the real reason. The real reason is to identify you and be able to track you and, control, you know, force you to use it to get a job and all of that kind of stuff.
Yep. The real money's in the registration, the yearly registration fee, which I totally forgot to pay mine on my truck. So I owe like $500 on my registration. And my tags are totally expired, and I'm like, oh, crap. I guess getting back to what we're talking about. So the voluntary versus coercion, we're talking about the massive amount of taxes that don't come in the form of just taxes. That also comes in the form of permits, licensing, registration, all that junk.
Right.
So we got a good handle on that. So what's the voluntary side? What is the voluntary side of agorism?
Well, it just means that if I'm in any kind of interaction with another person, it has to be by my choice. And if it is by my choice and it is by the other person's choice, nothing else in that relationship matters. Whether it's that I'm selling you raw milk, or whether it's that I'm selling you heroin or whatever it is, if it's voluntary on both sides, there should be no government involved saying what we can and cannot do together voluntarily.
So let's go back and address the heroin. So, you know, Cody brought up a point and he said, well, you know, heroin, like you take heroin and, you know, it's really bad for you and your health and your mental state, but you are technically like hurting your family and hurting your friends by being a heroin taker. So why would it really kind of be okay to take heroin in the eyes of, like, in an anarchist perspective of this, you have the ability to make your own choices? Like, how is that not harmful? Why should it not be illegal? I guess is what I'm asking.
Most anarchists don't believe that it's okay to take heroin.
Yeah.
Most of them all agree that it's a bad choice. But there has to be a line somewhere of where do we draw the line to say what someone can and cannot do? Where are we going to put that line?
Yeah.
And so when you talk about something like heroin or any kind of vice, cigarettes, alcohol, marijuana, gambling, any of those devices that we can make you can legitimately make an argument that it's bad for you to do that thing. Who is going to decide which one of those bad things is legal or illegal?
Yeah.
Like, for example, in my opinion, alcohol is worse for you than marijuana.
Yeah.
Why is alcohol legal and marijuana isn't? Well, yeah. Isn't in some places still. So the point really isn't whether something is bad for you or whether it is not. It is more about where do we draw the line about what should be prohibited and what shouldn't, and whose choice should it be?
Yeah.
And the anarchist says it should be the individual's choice always, with the exception of the non-aggression principle.
Yeah.
So like you're not allowed to go kill people. You're not, you know, if you choose to do something that is harming you, and I do understand that you harm people in the periphery because they love you, but you're not physically harming them.
Yeah, that's
true. Now, if you are physically harming them, then that is what is wrong, not the heroin. If you are stealing from your family to buy your heroin, well, you have gone against the non-aggression principle by stealing, not by using heroin.
That's a good point, and we cannot assume that all heroin use is hurting people, because everything is in context. So, you know, 95% right. of heroin users are probably hurting their loved ones emotionally. But maybe there's a percentage of heroin users that are dying of AIDS, and they cannot access prescription medication. So they use heroin to numb their excruciating pain to get through their end of life, you know? So where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
Well, you can't really draw a line unless you know every single context of the situation.
Right. And that's why the anarchist says the choice should always be the individual's.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Because only that individual knows their choices. And it just might be that they're just making crappy choices, but they're their choices to make.
Yeah.
As long as they're not going against the non-aggression principle.
Is it violent by proxy, though? Because the heroin has to be bought and sold, and at some point somewhere there is violence within transacting heroin, gang violence, slavery, etc. Like, can we possibly say that the non-aggression principle is being violated just in the purchasing of drugs?
Well, you can say it is because it's prohibited. Like, is there violence in the purchase of alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's violence in the purchase of alcohol anywhere down the line, unless you're just talking about an asshole.
Yeah.
But it's because it's legal.
Mm-hmm.
It's because it's legal. It's not prohibited. When alcohol was prohibited, there was lots of violence involved in the distribution and sale of alcohol.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. Yeah, okay, I get it now. Because if heroin wasn't, like, you know, demonized and made illegal, then people could just literally above board. Like, it's like these little niche distilleries and niche breweries that come around, you know, like...
Right.
Oh, we've got a poppy field in our backyard, and we make our own heroin, and we sell it, and it takes the violence out. Like, criminalizing things creates violence.
That's right.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
You know, as an agorist, I'm okay working in the gray and the black market, but we talked about the red market, which is where violence lives. Mm-hmm. There are people out there who are, they're not agorists, they're criminals, and they don't mm-hmm. mind working in the red market. I mean, that's where I stand anyway, as far as voluntary.
Yeah, and I get that because, you know, I was questioning, like, yeah, how is heroin not okay? How can we kind of, like, stomach that pill? But when you break it down like that, yeah, I mean, it makes sense, you know? It's really about, like, stripping down to who makes these decisions. And, you know, you rewind 50 years and you look at, you know, Reefer Madness and how, you know, pot was just so demonized back then and how it is today. So you literally can rewind and fast forward 50 years and we just are constantly, like, shocked. And I was actually just talking to my friends about this last night, where we're talking about normalcy
and what's normal and what's not, and how we're all just kind of weird and we're kind of normal-ish. And I'm like, you know what? You can rewind 50 years or you can go forward 50 years. And I can guarantee you the people that see us from the 1950s would be like, what the hell is wrong with these people?
Right.
You know, and we rewind to like the people from the 50s and we're like, oh my goodness, like segregation and, you know, all that stuff. What the hell is wrong with these people? You know?
Right.
So it's really like perception. So how can we just perceive?
It's also another reflection of the state. Like, yeah. The reason segregation was a thing was because the state was mostly run by racists.
Yep.
I mean, that's just the way it is. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the segregation. I think that if you eliminated the state, society as a whole would evolve faster past these things that that hold us back, like racism and things like that. I think if you got rid of government, if the state was not involved, there would be less of that.
That's a good point. Well, because they hold on to the red tape so hard and the bureaucracy so hard for so long in a state system. Whereas if humans were just allowed to be humans, we would like, yeah, these issues would come up, but it would take maybe only 6 months instead of 20 years to evolve past shitty ideas.
Yeah. I mean, who knows the time frame, but
who knows?
Just
yeah.
Look at the sheer size of the state. I mean, it's a juggernaut, you know, trying to get it to change directions just takes massive amounts of energy and time.
And money,
yeah.
And lobbying, and protesting, and writing your state official. I mean, it's just like, blah. You know, the most common sense, obvious things that need to be changed takes way too long to change them.
Well, and, you know, in a voluntary market, mm-hmm. let's use racism, for example. Let's say a racist opens up a coffee shop and is going to exclude anyone who's not German.
Mm.
Or no, let's...
Yeah, German's good. German's good because it's unexpected. Let's okay, just, keep going.
So, that guy, if he's racist for a negative reason, like he only likes Germans and he doesn't like anyone else,
mm-hmm.
first of all, anyone else, they're not going to want to go.
Yep.
Like, they don't want to go to his shop anyway. And a lot of the other Germans who are not racist, they're not going to go. Like, they're just not going to give that guy their money. And so that guy's going to go out of business really quick because the state has nothing to do with it. Mm. Right?
True.
So the state is not backing him up and the state, like, there's just no state. And so it's only the market that determines whether that guy is successful or not. And he's not going to be successful. Especially today, but let's mm-hmm. move it back 50 years. Like 50 years ago, he would have gone out of business also if there was no state.
Mm-hmm. True. Very true.
And so we would have moved past all of that much quicker without a state.
Well, and it's funny you bring that up because in Billings, Montana, there was a business owner who was opening up a venue and it was like, really cool. It was going to be a coffee shop slash concert venue. So, and it wasn't going to be a huge concert venue. It was just going to be like maybe a little bit bigger than your average coffee shop. So kind of like, you know, how a bar does, like a bar and you get to hear some live music. It's coffee and live music.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to have like all these cool local bands and like we were all so hyped about it. But then he got onto social media, namely Facebook, and he was blatantly racist. I mean, I'm talking like straight up dissing black people and just kind of white is right attitude. That building, like his business never even opened. That's how fast it got shut down.
Right.
But if racists were protected by the state, he probably would have never even gotten, you know, shut down. Like, if the state was involved and it's like, well, we have to do our due process and
is what he said really what he meant? You know, and then you're going through trials and lawyers and lobbying and BS. Like, so yes, right, it's way more efficient to just let humans handle it.
So let's go back. Let's go back before the Civil War. And let's pretend that there was no state and the South had slavery. How long would slavery have lasted if there was no law that said you can't teach a slave to read, you can't harbor a runaway slave, all the laws that protected the slave owner at that time?
Yeah.
What if none of those laws existed? How long would slavery have lasted, and would there had to have been a war about it?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, I don't think it would have lasted long.
Yeah, it's interesting when you start removing the state from, these scenarios we're talking about, and then you just remove the state entirely, and how everything just magically solves itself all of a sudden.
Right.
It's really mind-blowing and fun.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we've decided that we like voluntary market over, you know, the coercion of our money and just being taken from us forcibly.
Yeah.
So we went over the, I think we have a good understanding of what agorism is, but what about counter-economics? Because those two get confused.
Yeah, they're used interchangeably quite a bit. And that's okay because, most people who are in the agorist space, they know what you're talking about and it's no big deal. There are some snobs that will, you know, well, I won't even go there.
Well, there's always philosophical snobs that are armchair this or that, but yeah.
Right. So
armchair anarchists, you know, armchair agorists,
an armchair,
you know,
anarchist. Right. Right.
That's what I call it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's right. That's what it is.
Like armchair safety people, like on the pipeline, you know, sometimes you just got to do things a little rodeo to get that pipe in the ground. But then the armchair safety man is like, oh, no, no, you have to have your bell hole sloped out 2-to-1 ratio all the way to the floor of the bell hole. But that's like pipeliner talk. We move past that. Anyways, so what is counter-economics then in relation to agorism?
So counter-economics is the tactic. It is the way in which you deprive the state of income and influence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So agorism is the theory, and counter-economics is the tactic. It's the way in which you do it. So you operate within gray and black markets, which we've just discussed before, which I'll say again is the gray market is something, the action itself is not illegal, but requires some sort of permit, license, or whatever from the state. And so you're doing it in such a way that it makes it illegal. That's the gray market.
Yeah.
And the black
like
market
a lemonade
is,
stand or a yard sale is gray market.
Right. Or, cutting hair without a license from the state haircut or whatever. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what controls barbers. That kind of stuff.
Yep. Got it.
And
check.
The black market is anything that is absolutely prohibited by the state. So there we're talking about drugs and prostitution and I don't even know what else.
That's good. Drugs and prostitution. Yep.
Yeah.
And then there's also the red market, which would be violence against others. Because at least prostitution is still consensual and, you know, drug dealing and drug use is still consensual between the two. It's just illegal in the form of the state. Red market is violence against another, like a snuff film, child pornography. That's the red market. So
human trafficking. And so,
okay.
So that's the main difference.
Okay. I think we've all dabbled in counter economics.
Yeah, for sure.
To some degree.
Yeah.
My first counter economics business idea, like I'm a business idea person, like I'm kind of just like a natural born hustler. And I was like 5 years old, and I made watercolor paintings of like a parrot. And I made like copies of this painting. So I made like 10 different watercolor paintings of a parrot. And I went door to door back when that was like safe and acceptable. And I sold these parrot paintings, which were probably god awful, but I was only charging 50 cents. And like most people bought it, but hey, you know what? Some people told me no.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of glad they did, because I learned at a very early age not everyone's going to buy your crap.
Right, right.
You know?
Like, you've got...
At first, I was a little offended. Like, as a five-year-old, I'm like, you ain't going to buy my parrot? Yeah,
right.
Painting? What the hell's wrong with you? But then I just moved on to the next guy, and I'm like, oh, here's 50 cents.
Right.
You know? That was my first recalled memory of being a counter-economics participant.
My first... I'm kind of like you in that I've always been a little entrepreneur. And my first was back in grade school. So the school that I went to, at lunch, you got a little deal of milk. But if you had a quarter, you could upgrade that milk to a chocolate milk, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so my friends would, you know, we liked the chocolate milk, but sometimes my friends didn't have the quarter. So I would loan them the quarter on the idea that, okay, I'll get you a chocolate milk today. Tomorrow, you got to bring me 50 cents. So I was like a loan sharky.
Dang!
Yeah, it was
that's higher level hustling right there.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was as brutal as it was. You know, I didn't realize I was charging 100% interest kind of thing. But yeah, that was my first
thing.
That's
like loan shark material.
Yeah. In fact, I got shut down. Like, the school shut me down, so...
Oh, you got shut down.
Yeah.
Yeah, the man stepped in on that one. So, I think that's hilarious.
Yeah.
But it's like, who was it really hurting, you know? Like, I could see, that's kind of like the payday loan, too. You know, maybe you should have just charged 5 cents instead of
It was also a perfect example of a voluntary arrangement. I mean, I didn't force anyone.
It was completely voluntary.
That's right.
Yeah, so why would they shut you down? You know, no one's getting hurt.
So it's a good example of agorism.
That is too funny.
In that I should have been wiser and not allowed the state, i.e. the school, I should have done things a little bit more sly. I should have been quieter about what I was doing.
You learned that, though.
Yeah.
You learned it.
Yeah.
That got the wheels, that got the ball turning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is too cute. All right. So then, you know, not all counter economists are going to be agorists. But I would say all agorists are counter economists.
Yeah, except I would change that a little bit. So when you say that not all counter economists are agorists, I would say they are agorists, but they might not know it.
Yeah.
Because it is agorism, and you just might not know it because you might not be intentionally thinking about the state when you do it.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's a good point that we don't have to go to the full extent of feeling like we want to deprive state from the money. We could just be in kind of more the neutral happy zone of, hey, I just would like to keep the money that I've earned and not pay taxes on it.
Right.
Whereas I feel more and more as we talk more and more about, you know, the state and economics, I'm feeling more and more compelled to just really wanting to withhold my money from the state for the sheer fact that they're assholes.
Well, I can tell you in my life, nearly every financial decision I make involves a consideration of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly every one of them. So, I've evolved to that point over a decade now.
Yeah, it's a conscious heightening of awareness when you start really looking at what they're taking from you.
And the idea that they force you to support things you wouldn't support otherwise is criminal. when you really think closely about it. If you stop to think about it and allow yourself not to say, well, it's for the greater good. I mean, that's where people get hung up most of the time. So,
well, I'd like to address that. Okay, the morals. Let's go to the morals of why it's okay to not pay taxes. Because I think people do get morally hung up in the sense of, well, our taxes pay for schools, our taxes pay for roads, our taxes pays for police, etc., etc. You know, the list goes on and on. So, okay. Yes, as much as I don't like paying taxes, I am doing the greater good, and maybe I don't want to deprive this great country of its taxes. Why is that a fallacy?
Okay. So we will just discuss the morality, and we will leave out the fact that we could have all those things without government.
Yeah.
The moral problem is, I don't own you. How do I justify forcing you to pay for something you don't agree with? Like, I don't.
Okay.
The only way I can get there, the only way that I can morally get there is if I shift my morality away from myself and give it to something above me, like government or God or some other entity that is above me. Because if I start with the idea that you and I are on equal footing and I don't own you and you don't own me, I don't have the right to force you to pay for anything. So I have to find a way to shift my morality to some other entity, which is normally what people do. They either use government or religion to do that.
Yep. To justify it.
Yeah.
To justify in their heads that it's okay that they're taking 30% of my paycheck for the quote-unquote greater good, almost like an omnipresent god-like state. When all of these things that are being paid for that are good could actually be run as their own entities without government. A police station could be made privately. A fire station could be made privately and funded privately through community fundraisings, and it would work.
Right. Justice is a business.
Yes.
And it could be treated like a real business as opposed to this semi-religious entity that somehow is above us all.
And then on the flip side, you know, how big of a portion of your taxes is going into a war that you didn't want, that is going into some bizarre law. You know, you hear about these hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on just the most, like, unbelievably ridiculous things. We hear it all the time, you know.
Yeah. Right.
That's our money being transferred into crap that we don't want or need. The fluff, you know, the lobbying. I mean, it's just so corrupt. And we go into that, what is the state episode? Is that where we really dive deep into this?
Yeah. And there are all kinds of examples of that of that morality being shifted. So, I mean, you can take it from the, let's say, you know, Hobby Lobby. If you work for Hobby Lobby, their insurance program is not going to pay for the morning after pill. Right. And so there's been all kinds of court cases where, you know, organizations like Planned Parenthood are trying to force Hobby Lobby to include those types of birth control that Hobby Lobby religiously disagrees with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's immoral for them to do that. You can't force Hobby Lobby to do something that is against their religion. Where do you have the moral standing to do that? Their employees are there voluntarily. They don't have to work for Hobby Lobby. They don't, you know, if
that's true.
If someone wants the type of insurance that includes abortion stuff, they can work somewhere else.
Yeah. Hobby Lobby is not the only place to work on the planet.
Right. It's not even one of the best places to work from what I hear, but I mean, that's
a
different
discussion.
I like Hobby
Lobby, though. They have a lot of cool stuff.
I do like going in there.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like literally almost like taking a vacation, just walking around a Hobby Lobby.
Right.
It's like the ultimate of distractions. It's like, hey, my day is really shitty. I'm going to go just wander Hobby Lobby for an hour and look at all the random shit they have.
Right. Look at all the cool-ass hobbies I could get myself into.
And then you buy a bunch of stuff, and you never actually, like, do anything with it, because ideas are worthless, so.
Ideas are worthless, that's right.
Yeah.
So, for me, the ultimate get-out-of-guilt-free card of not paying taxes is the unbelievably tremendous amount of money creation going on, and that they are literally digitally creating trillions of dollars. And trust me, trillions of dollars is not going back into the hands of the taxpayers. Trillions of dollars is not going into aiding the coronavirus battle. There is plenty of money that is disappearing into fluff and BS to make people at the top more rich. If they can print trillions of freaking dollars out of thin air and pump it into the stock market, they can print a couple billion dollars and infuse it into our school system or into the fire department or the police department. They make us feel like we're the ones supporting these. You know, it's really, that's not even the case anymore. They're just digitally printing us into oblivion. And the only reason that the dollar has any value is faith. So I'm like, you know what? They can live without my, you know, $10,000 of tax, you know, that I pay in income tax. They can live without my $10,000 of income tax, because what's $10,000 to $1 trillion? I really just don't feel bad anymore. I don't feel obligated anymore.
Well, and here's the agorist point of view. You just said they can live without my taxes. The agorist point of view is, I hope they can't live without my taxes.
Yeah.
Like, I hope this destroys them.
Yeah. Well, I would like if it became a mass adoption event. So let's say we all decided we're just not paying our taxes anymore and it becomes a mass adoption event. I mean, it could possibly happen. But the reality is that the government's just going to print themselves out of existence. So, I mean, that's what's really happening.
Yeah. So the theory of agorism is this, that if enough of us just form these little pockets of cooperation and we develop these systems. Like one of the examples is schooling. Like right now, I think we have a excellent opportunity as agorists to produce educational systems that far exceed public schooling. Like now is the perfect time to do that. And what will happen is people, statists who are good paying tax citizens, will see this system over here of this group of people who are educating their children and doing such a phenomenal job at it and at such a much lower cost with so much more efficiency that they will want to join that system, and they will leave the state system just when it comes to their educating their children, and they will move to this other agoristic system of education. And so the theory of agorism is that as that begins to happen in all aspects, policing, you know, groups of people hiring private protection and seeing how that works, and it's better than the state, because all private enterprise is better than the state. It's just a fact.
Way better. You can't argue better.
If you argue that point, you're usually just delusional. The idea is that as people move into these better systems and leave the state system one piece at a time, that the state actually becomes irrelevant over time and people just make the shift over. That's the theory. And then
that's the hope.
Right. And at some point there's in the theory is that at some point the government is going to be threatened by this movement at some point and attack it in one way or another. And there's lots of talks amongst really serious agorists about how do we get ready for that? How do we prepare ourselves for the time when the government decides we are too much of a threat to allow to go on?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all kinds of things being bantered around about creating private security firms and creating our own private judiciary. It's really fascinating stuff, and this is just an introduction, so we can't really get deep into it, but I'm sure that the future is going to hold lots of agorism episodes where we can get real deep and specific about these different topics.
Yeah, I think now that we've made several episodes and we've really started kind of honing in on like what really matters at this point in our, you know, human history, I feel like we are leewaying into the decentralized economy, the counter-economics economy. I think that's where we could help people the most, is really how to be resilient in a system that's failing, which we're seeing it fail right between our eyes, and we're getting paid dollars that are, you know, dollar for dollar worthless if you look at the money supply versus, you know, what we make and inflation. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's hard to go to work every day and like work your ass off for a dollar that we're starting to lose faith in. So how do you, you know, how can you protect yourself and diversify yourself and actually become resilient and possibly be profitable while the system fails and we're in a huge economic depression? It's possible. And I think we're heading that direction. Yeah. I really like that direction.
Right.
So I'd like to go into how can we apply counter economics in our life in a way that is legal, safe, enjoyable, but also like sustainable to the point of being able to phase out our crappy 9-to-5 jobs that we all hate. How is this possible? I think a lot of people might be asking that, like, I don't know how I could really truly be a practicing agorist or counter-economist. Like, how do I even put that into my life? It's nice to hear about it. You know, just another worthless idea, quote unquote, but how do you really put it into action?
Right. Well, you start out simple. Just start out with the easy stuff. You know, the government allows for you to be an agorist to a certain degree. Number one, because they know they're out there. Now, the government's never going to use this term, but the idea that the government allows you to earn a certain amount of money every year without filing taxes on it is the loophole for the agorist. So you can start there. There's a certain amount of number. There's a certain number, and I don't know what it is. Maybe we should look it up.
Yeah, I've heard different numbers. I heard anywhere from like $600 a year, which seems really low, to like $20,000 a year. And I can tell you that you can circumvent a lot of it. So start with what you can do by keeping money completely off the radar.
Right. So
really, right?
Yeah. So let's say I mow lawns for a living. Well, if someone pays me cash, I'm not putting that cash in the bank. I'm not claiming that cash on my taxes. I'm not claiming any cash. I'm using that cash to buy my everyday things that can't be tracked, like soda pops and groceries and all of that kind of stuff. So you start there. And then you have this portion of money that if someone is paying you with a credit card, there's a certain number that I don't have to claim anyway, legally. So I'm not claiming that. Mm-hmm. And then if someone pays you with a check, like and when I say a check, I'm talking about an individual who pays me to mow their lawn and they pay me $50 and they give me a check. Mm-hmm. I'm not putting that check in my bank account either. I'm going to be a little bit inconvenienced and I'm going to that person's bank and I'm cashing that check. So that way, the only chain of evidence that I receive that money is if that other person gets audited.
Yeah.
Then they can find out, oh, this guy came to this person's bank and cashed this check and got cashed. Maybe we should go look at him, which I assure you, they do not do. They don't do it because they don't have the manpower. There's too many people that already do that, and they don't even call themselves agorists. Like, lots of people do that. Contractors are notorious for it. Those are just some simple little things right there that you can do that all of that is completely within the law.
Yeah, and we could even take it down into an even smaller notch of just selling stuff you don't need anymore.
Yeah.
On, you know, Facebook Marketplace, meeting someone in person, you always sell in cash.
Yeah.
You know, like when you meet someone and you do a swap or like selling at a flea market, it's never above board, typically. You know, I think flea markets, actually, they do make you kind of start filing forms if you're there like once a week, you know, in farmers markets. But there's like, you can do so many trips before you have to like provide your business license information or some shit like that. Garage sale. That's a good one.
There's two flea markets by me that I've been involved in that there's no requirement whatsoever of any kind. None. Mm-hmm. There's even a couple of the, like, what they're not called swap meets. They're like antique shops where you can buy a booth and leave your stuff there, and it's like a store.
Yeah.
Those places, they don't, I mean, they pay you in cash, but they're not giving you a 1099 or anything.
So there's like, so many ways that you can practice agorism in your everyday life. Like, there's too many ways. We could sit here and talk 5 hours about the ways how you can make money without having to pay taxes on it or circumvent your taxes. So what we've actually done is we've created a PDF, a free PDF download of 101 ways to practice counter economics. And we go over all kinds of just cool ideas that are just, they're totally approachable. If you get that, if you download our PDF and you tell me that there is not a single thing you can do on that list, you're just freaking lazy, basically.
You're never going to be an agorist.
No. One of my ideas is like to literally pick up pine cones and sell them on Etsy. And it's totally doable and people totally buy them. So if you can't like pick up a pine cone in your backyard, or it could be like a piece of driftwood or a shell or a pretty rock, like people buy this stuff.
That's right.
I'm not kidding. So there's some really cool creative ideas that you probably like wouldn't have even thought of, that we've just brainstormed this really cool list. So go to the offgridoutpost.com. It's right there on the main page. All you got to do is plug in your email. We'll send you a newsletter from time to time with like a bunch of cool stuff in it and ideas and tips, and get the free PDF.
And we won't sell your email to anyone else.
Oh no, we are pro privacy, anti data collecting, 100%.
Right. The only reason we'll use that email address is just to send you stuff, or just to send you little notifications like when we've got a new podcast coming out or something like that. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. You know, let's let people know we have a podcast coming out. We can let you know any interesting things we come across. We'll compile in a cool little newsletter and send out, you know, once or twice a month.
Yeah.
I did want to, like, just quickly put out there the ongoing silver challenge, which you did.
I did.
Which was really cool.
Yeah.
Give us a quick 30-second synapse of what you did to complete the silver challenge.
Right. So, I sold a jar of moonshine for $20.
That you make.
That I make. Mm-hmm. That I then went to a, like, mom-and-pop coin shop. And the guy sold me a silver round, which is just an ounce of silver, 0.99% troy ounce. Sold it to me for $19. And last time I looked, it was worth like $28. And that was a couple weeks ago.
And that was a week ago, right?
I think it's been a little more than a week now.
It's been like 10 days, yeah. So basically, you took your counter-economic created money.
Yes.
So right there, you've saved 30% because you haven't had to pay taxes on it. So your $20 was really worth more like $23.25, you know.
Yeah.
But that, okay, that's besides the point.
So then you
turned it into silver, which has literally appreciated in value by 30% in like 10 days.
The last time I checked. I mean, I haven't checked in like 3 days. So the way it was going, it's probably more now.
I think the over spot right now is 29. So I just want to say, like, you have your spot price of silver, which is your stock market price. But then the over spot price is what you can actually purchase or sell your silver for. And over spot is always more because that's based on actual physical supply and, you know, supply and demand. Real right. economics, not paper economics. So,
right.
Yeah. 29, I think, was the last time I checked the over spot.
Yeah. And so in that transaction, there were no taxes paid. If I was a law-abiding citizen, a good taxpayer, number one, I probably wouldn't have been able to make the moonshine, but let's say I did. There's enormous taxes involved in being able to legally make my own whiskey. So there was no taxes.
So that $20 moonshine is, you'd probably keep, if you could even legally do it, which that's moot. You would probably keep $10 of it, or maybe even $8.
Yeah.
So your purchasing power is much larger when you cut the government out.
Right. And
it really is much larger.
And the guy that I sold it to, of course, he didn't pay any taxes. There were no sales tax involved. He could have gone to the liquor store to get his whiskey and paid taxes, but he didn't. So, there was that. And then when I bought the silver coin, the guy didn't charge me any kind of sales tax. And I'm certain that he's not claiming any kind of income tax. So.
Heck no.
That's all agorism. And now I have a form of real money that the government can't depreciate through inflation. So it was good all around.
Yeah, that was like the perfect transaction.
And as a store of value, it has already earned 30% interest. So lots of pluses.
Really cool.
They don't have to do it in the same way that I did if they don't want to be that risky. It's like you originally had said, it's just a matter of selling something you don't use anymore, right?
Yeah, like sell some Pyrex, you know, that goes for some good quid. Mm-hmm. Sell some tools. Tools always go well, you know. Sell it on, you know, Facebook Marketplace. That's probably like the best marketplace right now to transact face-to-face, because I think Craigslist has kind of gone the way of the spammers. Craigslist is kind of outdated.
Yeah.
There's also like selling apps like Mercari. I really like Mercari, but then you have to ship stuff and they get a fee too. But these are all marketplaces where you have to hit like a $20,000 level of selling before you file taxes or get your 1099, I should say.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to transact, you know. You don't even have to do a garage sale. You know, you don't even have to like deal with people in person. You can ship things and collect money through payment apps that are, as long as you stay under a minimum, which is fairly high, you'll be okay. Sell the damn thing, go to your freaking local market, your local pawn shop, and buy some silver. That's basically the gist of the challenge.
Yeah.
I don't give investment advice. I just give you like my ideas and thought patterns, so you have to, you know, invest at your own risk. But I see silver going to $50 an ounce by the end of the year. I feel like I'm almost certain of it.
Yeah.
On my own accord, you know, on my own thought patterns.
Right.
And so we're at 30, so you're like, eh, well, I missed the run. You know, I missed it. I should have bought at 15 or 12. Like, that's emotional trading, okay? You just take the emotions out of it. You look at the situation that we're in. Our economy, I mean, okay, we just had a, what was it? It's either 23 or 32% dip in GDP.
33%.
2008 was 8%. 33?
It was 33% annualized.
So not like quarter over quarter, but yeah.
It was a 9% drop in the quarter, which is a lot.
That's mega huge. Like they're wanking over like a 0.5% gain. Oh, our GDP only went up 0.5%, or oh, it's going to be flat this year. Oh, recession. No, we're at -9% in one quarter.
Yeah, that's really big.
So that makes me really bullish on silver.
So to give you an idea of how big.
And gold.
So they annualize it every time. So when they say we dropped 33%, that's projected throughout an entire year. We have never had that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Great Depression, the worst was like 30%. So we're already, that's a bigger dip than the Great Depression.
Wow. Yeah, so we're in unprecedented economic times, folks. Like, come on, you know, wake up and smell the roses. You think $30 silver is expensive? Just wait till it's at 50 or 75. Yeah. I mean, really, like, take the emotions out of it. Yeah, did you miss it when it was really cheap? Yeah, I'd say we all freaking did. You know, I didn't buy silver at $10 an ounce a year ago.
I wish I had now. Hindsight's 20/20. Is it going to keep me from buying silver now? Hell no.
And
but you got to do what's right for you.
$30 is not the silver's is not the high for silver. So we already know it's we're probably not at the top because that's not the high. That's not the, you know, 30 is not the record high for silver. It was like,
yeah, I think the record was 50-ish.
Yeah, it was yeah, almost 50. I think it was still in the 40s, but it was touching 50.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know for
sure. And that
sure.
was maybe a handful of years ago. I don't remember how many years ago, but yes, it did happen when the dollar had more value, you know, so you got to also account for inflation.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas gold is reaching all-time highs, and I love gold and I own gold. A gold is like a third of my portfolio. Do I wish, looking back, I probably should have just bought all silver, but I didn't because I like to have a little diversity. But trust me, I'm not kicking myself in the pants by any means for buying gold.
Right. Yeah.
You know. But I think silver is just really where it's at because gold is reaching all-time highs. People are excited about gold. People are going to FOMO gold. FOMO is fear of missing out, so it's just going to keep skyrocketing that price.
Mm-hmm.
But the silver, we haven't even touched our all-time highs yet. So there is a lot of potential for silver right now. I'm talking 2x,
yeah.
4x, you know, it's huge. I'm bullish on silver pretty hard, as you can tell.
I can tell.
So do the challenge. Let us know. Take a photo of, like, you know, what you bought. That'd be really cool to see what people are buying. And you can email it to us at theoffgridoutpost@gmail.com. You can leave us a voice message. That's in the show notes, our link to leaving a voice message. So you can tell us about your little silver challenge journey. Leave a comment on the platform you're listening on. I mean, yeah, communicate with us. It'd be awesome to, like, hear people rising to this challenge. It'd make me feel good.
Yeah, what would be really cool is if you go buy the silver and then you take a picture of it and post it on Instagram and then friend us on Instagram so that we could see it.
Yeah, like, tag us. Yeah, that'd be awesome. I would love for, like, our Instagram feed to just, like, pop up with, like, just bunches of silver.
That'd be awesome.
That'd be so cool. Totally. So I think just the final quick touching on to the agorism is the class theory you were telling me about. It sounded interesting, and we don't want to go hardcore philosophical, but just to kind of touch on it, there's some interesting concepts.
Yeah, I'll just graze over it real quick. So basically, the agorist class theory says that there are two classes of people. There's the political class, which is the parasitic class, and it acquires its livelihood through the political means. And the political means being confiscation, taxation, coercion. And then there is, then there's the rest of us. If you're not within that political class, you are the rest of us. We are the productive class and we make our living through, peaceful, honest means and, through voluntary arrangements. You know, whether you're an employee, whether you're a business owner, entrepreneur, whether you're a solopreneur, whatever, that's the rest of us. And so wealth can only be acquired in two ways. It can either be acquired voluntarily through the market.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting because the parasites need the producer, but the producer doesn't need the parasite, but the parasite has convinced the producers that we need the parasite.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is parasitic.
Right. So it's not a relationship where both the host and the parasite gain something, because the host, us, we don't gain anything from government. They've just convinced us that we do.
And that's symbiosis.
Symbiosis.
You know, there's, like, symbiotic relationships in nature all the time. Like, you see the sharks with the little fishes
little
eating
sucker
the
fishes.
Little bugs off of its skin. Yeah, and then they also get protection from the shark. You know, that's symbiotic.
Right.
But I don't think... I think maybe there was one point when the state was more symbiotic and in balance with man.
Yes.
Maybe, like, there was a time when it was a better balance because the government was a lot smaller.
Well, I think there was a time in our history where the land was run by basically warlords. So villages would get ravaged by these warlords that, would come around every now and then and take all their stuff and take their women and whatever. And
pillaging.
So,
yeah.
You know, kingdoms arose around the idea of this one powerful overlord, warlord, is able to protect so many citizens from the other factions of warlords. So I think there probably was at some point a symbiotic relationship, but we're long past that. Like, I know people talk about terrorists trying to kill us and all of that stuff, but I honestly, in my entire life,
I don't feel threatened by terrorism, really.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I'm not even sure I've ever even met one, you know, so I don't think it's as big of a threat as what we're led to believe. And the government wants us to believe that there is an enemy that that we need them to protect us from, because otherwise, you know, that's just part of their, that's just part of their con.
Well, that's what feeds the massive military industrial complex
right.
that we have created. They have created.
Right.
And that's their justifications to keep it.
Exactly right.
You know, they're protecting us from the terrorists. The terrorists! You don't hear about that much anymore, though, you know? Like, we had the major ISIS crisis, and of course 9/11, and
well,
that was like so 2010.
Yeah, now we got COVID, so.
That's so 2001, you know?
Right.
Well, now we have, yeah, we have COVID, which is our little internal parasitic terrorists.
Yeah. We have a new enemy.
It's interesting how the enemy always seems to change with the news cycles.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to downplay 9/11, and I don't want to downplay ISIS, because there was some really bad shit. And of course, there's always the, you know, the conspiracy theories that it didn't happen. And I don't even want to, like, touch that, because we've already agreed to a non-conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
We go tinfoil hat sometimes, but we've agreed to, like, the non-conspiracy path.
Right.
But it is odd that our enemy is just always changing to whatever they decide to make the enemy at the time. Like, you know, global warming is really kind of phasing out now. I don't hear much about it so much. And they got a shit ton of money from that whole thing, you know.
Yeah, we'll hear about it again.
Now we will. That's not done yet.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. There will always be an enemy in front of us if we're left to believe what the state tells us. There will never not be an enemy of some sort.
Yeah. But it always justifies the taxes and the control.
Mm-hmm. That's how they make their money, the government. That is the...
Through fear and coercion.
Yeah, right. That is the...
If you don't pay us this taxes, you're not going to have a police department and crime is going to run rampant. If you don't pay us taxes, you're not going to have a fire department and your whole city's going to burn down. It's all based on fear.
Your children are going to be stupid if you don't let us educate them.
Well, what happened to this No Child Left Behind Act that we spent a bajillions of taxpayer dollars on, and now, like,
right.
And now our, you know, our children's IQ levels are, like, hitting rock bottom, and we're like, I don't even know how low our system is, like, our educational system in the world is, but we're cranking out, like, our numbers are not good. But No Child Left Behind, like, it's just, ugh.
It's like the government is the worst service provider ever.
They are. Awful.
And people still, you know, even with all of the evidence that the government is the worst service provider ever, people still think that paying their taxes makes them a good person.
Yeah. Because that's how ingrained and brainwashed they have gotten us. And I, trust me, I've been one of those people. You know,
yeah,
I've
too.
Worked above board jobs pretty much my whole life. Yes, I've always had an additional side hustle going on, making me dollars off the table. But in
right.
general, you know, I'd say 2/3 of my income has always been above board. And I've been taught to just accept these taxes that come out, and we all grumble about it and hem and haw about it. But then there gets to a point where it's just like, I'm done. I'm done participating
mm-hmm.
in this shit system where I'm just getting ripped off. Where 30% of my life is being taken from me, because if I'm at work 10 hours a day, then 3 out of those 10 hours, probably closer to 4 out of those 10 hours, they don't even come back to me. And then I'm paying sales tax, which adds up to however many more hours I had to work to pay the tax on the things I purchase.
Right.
And on and on and on. Registration and, you know, all that stuff.
You're just trading your life away to these criminals that call themselves a government.
Yeah, look at the parasite relationship in this sense. So let's say that your cash flow in your life is blood flow in your body, mm-hmm. just to use an analogy. There is a tick on your body that is so big that it takes 40% of your blood.
That's huge.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. So think of how big that tick would be.
It would be huge if you compared the government to a tick.
Yeah.
It would be bigger than you, probably. You'd be dead.
So, I mean, I don't know why people can suck you dry. Yeah, I don't know how we got to the point where this is acceptable from so many people.
How have we gotten to this point? It's got to be the slow boil theory of you put the frog in the boiling water and it jumps out. And yeah, it's got to be that because there's just no way. And then our kids are just born into the system and, you know, they're expected of all this. But, you know, I'm seeing a big movement of like the 20-somethings. They're all getting into the gig economy.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, because they're like, I'm going to get a job that's going to pay me like $10 or $11 an hour. And then 40% of that is going to be taken because I have no kids. And then the 60% that's left is going to go to rents and basic living expenses that I can't even afford. And then they're constantly bombarded with like flashy things like, oh, you should buy this and you should buy that. And I think there's a big movement happening in the younger generations, like the 20-somethings and even the teen-somethings that are like, I can generate money on my own through a gig economy and I don't need all your shit. I do not need those fancy shoes and I do not need that fancy handbag. I think they're becoming minimalists and I think they're becoming counter-economists as well.
Yeah. And they're better off for
We're seeing this movement happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're better off for
it.
And there's two ways to look at this too. So from the perspective of someone in my generation, look at the amount of taxes you pay right now. And I know you're disgusted by it. And then look at the amount of money that the government is shoveling into the economy right now and think who pays for that? Because we don't.
Yeah.
We don't have enough life left in us to pay for what is being pumped into the economy right now. Who pays for it are those 20-somethings and those kids that are 5 years old right now. It's going to hit them so hard that if the dollar survives long enough for them to have to still be paying taxes, they're going to be paying like 60% in taxes to pay for what we're spending right now. It's ridiculous. So if you're in my generation,
if they can even keep this broken system going.
Right. So if you're in my generation, look at it like that. Like, look at what your grandkids are going to have to go through. And that is a good enough reason to start living an agoristic life. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is for those of you that are 20 something and you're trying to figure out life right now and you're looking at how you should do things. The idea of the gig economy, the idea of being a nomadic person living in a van or a schoolie or a RV and living an agoristic life, that all contributes to solve this problem that we call government. So if that's where you're headed in your life, if you're looking at that minimalistic lifestyle, self-employment where you determine your own destiny, you're on the right track. That is a good path to be on right now.
I think for a lot of people, a lot of younger people, there's nowhere else to turn. To be honest, they're looking for the answer of how the hell am I going to survive this world and this economy? And you literally have to make your own world and your own economy.
Yeah.
They're almost forced to opt out.
Yeah. And
that's how bad inflation has become. That's how bad the rents have become and the low wages have become is they almost have to make the choice to be an agorist just to survive.
Yeah. And it's even harder for you if you bought into the lie about go into debt and get a college education. I mean, college education has never costed so much.
Well, and that facade is starting to crumble down as well. A lot of facades are starting to crumble. And I think the younger generations are waking up to it.
Yeah.
Because they can't foot this bill. when you print out $1 trillion, like, you know, it's in the form of bonds or some BS that has to be supposedly repaid at, you know, later down the road or something. There's some sort of tie to borrowing against future generations is what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, the debt has to be supposedly repaid at some point, but we've gone above and beyond. So you have to become resilient at some point and realize the system is broken. And I feel like the younger generations have an actual viewpoint of really being able to see the system broken, where our generations have been ingrained in the system so hard when it was actually kind of working a little better. It wasn't as obviously broken. Yeah, that's all very interesting.
Yeah, and I would also like to point out one more thing about some of the differences about agorism. When you're talking about the difference between agorists and regular anarchists, so an agorist is an anarchist, but not all anarchists are agorists. And so anarchists argue with each other a lot about which kind of anarchy is the best kind of anarchy. And to give you a good idea of who the agorist is, so the agorist is the person who's not really arguing about anarchy, because you can be any kind of anarchist you want. Just start being free. Start living like it. Start acting like it. Work inside the gray and the black market and keep your money from the state at every opportunity that you can, and find these little pockets of freedom and live with inside these pockets of freedom and try and expand them. Don't care whether you're an anarcho-capitalist, an anarcho-communist, a minarchist. Doesn't matter. The agorist is the guy saying, let's just do it. I'm done talking about it.
Yeah, you don't need to label yourself or fight for your right or this or that or protest or riot or do anything. You could just opt out. Like, just make the choice to do it and opt out. Like, I'm going to start up a little lawn mowing service or a leaf collecting service. Or, you know, it's a really good service that you can make crap tons of money. You know what it is?
No. What?
Picking up dog shit. I almost started a pooper scooper business because, like, each turd is a dollar sign.
Oh my gosh. So, like,
so yeah.
I would
is
almost.
Is that not the perfect job?
Like, I would almost.
I almost want to do it again.
Do that just. I would almost do that just so that I could say I picked up dog shit for a living. Like, just to be able to say that would be hilarious.
Turning
awesome.
Shit into dollars. I mean, literally turning poop into gold. Like, I have to. Yeah. That's a good one. I almost did it. I really, like, deeply considered it, and I, like, researched my competition and everything, and I realized, like, I could make, like, 50 to 100 grand a year just picking up dog shit if I charged per turd.
That is hilarious.
Like, you I didn't even know that was a job. By the hour. You don't charge by the hour. Absolutely not. You charge by the turd.
Yeah.
That's funny. That way you never work yourself out of your business, because when you charge dollars for hours and then you get better at what you do, you become more efficient. So you are, you know, like, making yourself out of business for becoming more efficient, you've got to charge by the turd.
Right.
Absolutely. So, like, yeah, maybe I really just, like, completely derailed my train of thought there. But
well, that's okay.
What were we talking about?
The idea is just think outside of the box. So give up the notion of the employee-employer relationship, because it's a crappy relationship. So...
Oh yeah.
In our current society, it's kind of necessary, but we can phase it out. So think outside of that paradigm and just look at yourself as, I'm the person responsible for earning money. How can I do it? And don't exclude anything. Like, everything is on the table. All ideas are good. You know, like, how are we going to do this? And then make a plan and do it. Like we were talking about earlier, we've got a great PDF, and there are a ton of ideas on there, good ideas. And if there's not one on there that you can't do just as it's written, it's going to get your imaginative juices flowing, and you're going to come up with something just by reading the
list.
That's
true.
You're going to think, that's a good idea, but I could do this, you know?
Very few people could not pick up dog turds for a living.
Right. The number gets a little smaller when you exclude the people who aren't willing to.
Well, yes, okay, yeah, the don't want tos. The don't want tos versus the can't dos.
Right.
That is on the list, by the way, that idea.
That's awesome.
But yes, that's a good point. You know, if you can't do not a single thing on the list, it will stimulate your brain juices to figure out what you can do. And we'd love to hear that. And just extend the list, you know. Let's all make a bigger list and, you know, we can update this PDF with like more and more ideas. It might turn into like 1,000 ways.
That would be awesome.
You know, just from user feedback.
That would be cool.
Well, I think that kind of sums up, you know, what our thoughts were about the topic of the Agora.
Yeah.
Encounter economics. Is there anything you'd like to add before we close or?
I would say, too, another difference between a standard anarchist and an agorist. So a standard anarchist who is always trying to figure out how we replace the state and what it would look like when there is no state, and everything is projected into the future. And so they don't feel free because the state still exists, and that's their requirement for freedom, for the state to not exist. But the agorist feels free already because they are living like they are free. Yep. They are finding these little pockets of freedom and establishing their life around these pockets of freedom. And so they are more free than anyone else. So if freedom is something you're after, this is the way to get there.
Yes.
I've been living.
Well, it's kind of like Neo, you know, and when you live, you know, most people are living in the Matrix,
right,
unhappy, but then like Neo has the awakening and he has his life outside of the Matrix, but he can also go into the Matrix. You know, that's kind of like the agorist.
Yeah. And by the way.
You can live both sides.
And by the way, my favorite movie of all time.
Hell yeah.
Love that movie. But yeah.
I love that movie. I really like my favorite movie is like The Fifth Element.
That was a good one.
I love that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something just weird and quirky about it that just is so me. I feel like I am the fifth element sometimes.
Right. Yeah, so I don't have anything to add other than that. So I think we've covered the introduction to agorism pretty well.
Yeah, I feel good about it. Well, I want to thank you for tuning in. If you could rate this podcast, it really helps us get discovered on the various platforms. We'd also love to hear from you at theoffgridoutpost@gmail.com. You can leave us a voicemail. We do have a product recommendations page that if you go to theoffgridoutpost.com and check out, we receive a small portion of anything you purchase, and that helps keep this channel funded and going. So take a look at that kind of stuff, and we'll hear from you next time.
Talk to y'all later.
The end.
Here's a little teaser for what's coming next week.
Like the whole concept of money kind of starts to change when you start using cryptocurrency outside of our, you know, fiat system, our slave money system. So it's pretty liberating. It's really fun, actually.
Thanks for listening to the Off-Grid Outpost podcast. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe so you can get all the new episodes.